257, Part 2, Chapter 3 of Gulliver's Travels. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 257, Rush Rush. This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. And SeedPod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative. We publish books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? And Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And without further ado, here we go. I am in a flurry. Why, you ask? Because I am going to TNNA, and it didn't become clear that this was going to be able to happen until yesterday. So today, you're actually going to listen to just the book's audio, pretty much, because I don't have time to do anything except tell you, Holly Go Lightly socks, up, gorgeous, fabulous, and I'm not even going to do anything other than duplicate the show notes because I don't have time. And really, actually, the only really newsy news that I wanted to spend any time on today is to let you know that because of this trade show, Canterbury Tales will be coming out next week to the subscribers. So I thought I was going to get it out this week, and then the heavens open, and all sorts of good stuff has been happening, but boy, busy business over here. I've recorded, but I haven't edited, and I'm waiting for some new audio from my actor, and once that happens, you will have your very first episode of Canterbury Tales going out to the Just the Books and Craftlit subscriber supporters. If you are interested in receiving this exclusive audio, please visit the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com, where you can find out all about how to become a subscriber supporter. And Holly Go Lightly socks going out this week to subscriber supporters. And yeah, Canterbury Tales next week. Whew, very exciting stuff. But wasting no time today, however, Gulliver. This next section in Brobdingnag is where things start to really warm up for those of us who love satire. Now, again, I've mentioned this before, but I'm going to reiterate it because this is one of the sections where it becomes, I think, a little important to pay note to this. And I'm very proud to say that I am in the same league in this one small area of life as Isaac Asimov, because we are in agreement on the following. Brobdingnagians are not large representations of large, magnanimous, kind, gentle beings. They are just as fallible and, dare I say, human as the rest of us. And while it was funny to see the Lilliputians be acting so big when they were really very small, we now have the opportunity to see truly grand people be maybe not petty and small-minded, but certainly the bulls in the china shop. They will never see Gulliver as a small version of them. Whereas we got to see Gulliver, who we really like quite a lot, or we're supposed to anyway, we got to see him treat the Lilliputians as small versions of himself. You know, they may have been diminutive, but they had needs and they had fears, and he tried not to upset them or upset their way of life unduly. And of course, that wasn't always possible, but he gave it a good college try. You will not see that behavior from the Brobdingnagians. And this is one of those first chapters where it really starts to come into play. There's a couple of other things to take note of, and I don't want to spoil stuff because a lot happens in this chapter, and I want you to be able to be, you know, surprised or entertained by this next bit. But there are a few terms that I want to make sure you know, and a few situational things. One is you will hear him talk about a scrutore, which is a distortion of a French word, escritoire, which is just a French word for a writing desk. I probably butchered the French, and feel free to correct me in the show notes. There, you can put in the comments if I ever butcher the language or say something that you know is not true. Please feel free to share your knowledge so that everyone else can benefit from it, including me. People over at Craftlit tend to occasionally post in the show notes, but a lot of the conversation seems to happen at Ravelry, which allows them to have multiple threads going all at once. And I think it's actually kind of easier to track the different conversations there for people who aren't listening in real time. So I have a feeling that that's why that's not such a commented upon site. But Just the Books, you know, we don't really have a Ravelry. We have our show notes, just-the-books.com. One of the little bits that I thought was interesting is, as you're listening to this chapter, see if you agree with me, because I'm sure there's another way to look at it, but I think that Swift, starting with the Lilliputians, was very much a tactical move on his part. For one thing, it lets us start off feeling like we're the big people with Gulliver. But there's another thing, which is for Gulliver to have looked upon them as grand people, you know, the emperor and the empress, the king and queen in Lilliput, you know, he thought of and treated them as royalty, which they were in their dominion. I think it's important for us to recognize that as special behavior that perhaps not everyone would have participated in. Because if Swift had started with the Brobdingnagians, these huge people, and Gulliver treated their royalty as grand royalty, we just kind of go, oh, well, sure, because, you know, they're big and all. And so I think he may have been orchestrating it this way to make it easier for us to see some of the points that he's getting at. Yeah? You think? Because that's certainly the sense that I'm getting, especially as we head into this chapter, chapter 3 of part 2. Oh, another thing. He talks, I think we mentioned this way, way back at the beginning of the book, but just to reiterate, Swift talks about philosophy, and much of the time when he says philosophy, what he means in our modern world is science. That word science didn't really pop up until the 19th century. At least not being used the way that he's using it and the way that we tend to use it. And so it's, and they talk about philosophy. And there, isn't it even in Hamlet, there are more things, Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy? Your science. It's not just you're sitting around and pondering the universe. It's the study of these things. It was serious business. Now, last week, we talked about the madhouses. And going and watching the loonies dance and things like that. Well, there's another sadly typical form of entertainment that was used back in the day for a very long time, and that was keeping little people around dwarves. And if you have read Christopher Moore's book Fool, you have seen, I think, one of the most moving points of view, moving depictions of a point of view of a person in a position of this kind of power, where the fool in Bottom's case in the book Fool, and here in the Queen's favor in Brobdingnag. You have someone who is of smaller stature and hired and kept to entertain everyone. The fool in the Christopher Moore story is a far more pleasant person to hang out with than the guy here. And I think that this was Swift not so much making a societal comment on the keeping of fools and specifically dwarves, but I think that this is quite clearly commentary on the big small ratio thing that we've already had going with Lilliput and Brobdingnag, but to take someone who is still a giant to Gulliver and reduce him in size as far as the Brobdingnagians do, and then give him the characteristics, the personality characteristics that he does in this. I don't think this was a societal comment about fools. I think this is a societal comment about us. And we'll get that more on the flip side. But I just, when you start hearing about the Queen's Dwarf, start listening for where Swift is really going with that. That's where I'm heading. Now, to that end, with the fool situation, the philosophers, the scientists, are going to make a determination about Gulliver, and you're going to hear their term for him, which is made up by Swift, and I think is a silly term that is meant to sound kind of like something else, but then he translates it not into English but into Latin, and I'm just going to give this to you up front so that when you hear it, you can hear it for all its sad meaning. The Latin, which I am sure I will mispronounce. We begged for a Latin class when I was in high school, and we were told that it's a dead language and nobody needed it. That was from my principal. Not that I'm bitter. The Latin is lusus naturae. I think it's naturae. Yeah. It stands for freak of nature. Okay? So just know that when the scientists determine what Gulliver is in their language, that's where they're headed. But there's more to this. There's more to this kind of ridiculing of the scientists that Swift goes into. And it's not just ridiculing, you know, it's kind of like he's annoyed with and clearly sneering at and unhappy with the kinds of results that the scientists get to when they're studying Gulliver. And the word occult is used here. Occult causes. It doesn't mean anything like black magic or anything like that. It means hidden or, you know, concealed reality. So an occult reality would be a hidden reality just, you know, behind the veil. Like when Sirius Black dies and floats beyond the veil. It's that kind of meaning. It doesn't mean anything dark or sinister. However, we've already talked about the fact that Swift did not like Newton, that evidently quite a few people didn't like Newton, but Swift's disdain for Newton traveled outside of just Newtonian science and into the realm of modern science. There were lots of things that scientists were coming up with at this time in the late 16, early 1700s that Swift simply did not ken to. He didn't like it. He didn't agree with it. He thought it was all lame. And his bias will show up over and over again, especially in the third book. And I'm just telling you right now, Mr. Isaac Asimov has nothing but scorn back for Swift. I happen to think that there are some places, since Isaac Asimov has had edited this book back in, God, I don't know, even the 70s maybe, quantum physics has actually brought some interesting things back in, so I don't know that Swift was all that wrong in some cases, but you will hear him scorning scientists or philosophers of his day, and that's part of it, and you'll hear more and more of that as we go through the book. Now there was some discussion, actually back on Ravelry, about kind of the fierceness of the scene with Gulliver slaying the rat which, you know, yeah, because it's a big old rat, and rats, even when you're normal human size, they're mean and nasty, spiteful little buggers who will, you know, take a chunk out of you if they can, if they're afraid and threatened and I say this as someone who owned a white rat. Brown rats? New York City subway rats? Those suckers scare the bejujus out of me. I don't want to have anything to do with them. So I think it's kind of interesting. You're going to hear more and more, since Gulliver is very small and these things are very scary, about the numbers of vermin that he finds himself surrounded by. Because, of course, it's much easier to see them when you are their size or smaller. And I think one of the things that we learn from this isn't, ooh, that's gross. Yes, ooh, that's gross. But I think one of the things we learn from that is, wow, as modern and advanced as many things were that, you know, that we're learning about from Swift, there are ways of thinking that I find very modern. And as modern as they are, there's a lot of really disgusting stuff and a lot of rats and a lot of other things that Swift clearly noticed and Gulliver sees even more of. So I think it tells us a little bit about living back then. My husband, one of my husband's comments about time travel movies has always been that everybody has gotten it wrong, because if you travel back in time, the first thing you would be struck with is how god-awful it smells. And nobody ever does that. You know, nobody ever travels back in time and takes a deep breath and goes, this is horrible. What is that smell? That's the the teeming unwashed masses. That's what that is. That's what you're smelling there, baby. And yeah, we do seem to get a picture of that in this chapter from Mr. Swift. Now, once the Brobdingnagian king starts in on Gulliver, I want you to pay attention to what starts to happen. And we're going to talk about it on the flip side. But I think Swift, it's always moments like this in Shakespeare, in Marlowe, in Homer, in all of these pre-psychology books, things that happened before the study of modern psychology. I'm always amazed when they nail something that seems to me to be very modern. And you're gonna start to hear that as the king and queen start to talk to Gulliver. And I'm excited. It's fun. And on that note, I'm gonna play some audio. So let us dive in with Aaron Ziegler reading Chapter 3 from Part 2 of Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift.
Chapter 3. The author sent for to court. The queen buys him of his master the farmer and presents him to the king. He disputes with his majesty's great scholars, an apartment at court provided for the author. He is in high favor with the queen. He stands up for the honor of his own country. His quarrels with the queen's dwarf. The frequent labors I underwent every day made in a few weeks a very considerable change in my health. The more my master got by me, the more unsatiable he grew. I had quite lost my stomach and was almost reduced to a skeleton. The farmer observed it, and concluding I soon must die, resolved to make as good a hand of me as he could. While he was thus reasoning and resolving with himself, a slardrawl, or gentleman usher, came from the court, commanding my master to bring me immediately thither for the diversion of the queen and her ladies. Some of the latter had already been to see me, and reported strange things of my beauty, behavior, and good sense. Her majesty and those who attended her were beyond measure delighted with my demeanor. I fell on my knees and begged the honor of kissing her imperial foot. But this gracious princess held out her little finger towards me after I was set on a table, which I embraced in both my arms and put the tip of it with the utmost respect to my lips. She made me some gentle questions about my country and my travels, which I answered as distinctly and in as few words as I could. She asked whether I would be content to live at court. I bowed down to the board of the table and humbly answered that I was my master's slave, but if I were at my own disposal, I should be proud to devote my life to Her Majesty's service. She then asked my master whether he were willing to sell me at a good price. He, who apprehended I could not live a month, was ready enough to part with me, and demanded 1,000 pieces of gold, which were ordered him on the spot, each piece being about the bigness of 800 maidores. But allowing for the proportion of all things between the country and Europe, and the high price of gold among them, was hardly so great a sum as 1,000 guineas would be in England. I then said to the Queen, since I was now Her Majesty's most humble creature and vassal, I must beg the favour that Glumdalclitch, who had always tended me with so great care and kindness, and understood to do it well, might be admitted into her service, and continue to be my nurse and instructor. Her Majesty agreed to my petition, and easily got the farmer's consent, who was glad enough to have his daughter preferred at court, and the poor girl herself was not able to hide her joy. My late master withdrew, bidding me farewell, and saying he had left me in a good service, to which I replied not a word, only making him a slight bow. The Queen observed my coldness, and when the farmer was gone out of the apartment, asked me the reason. I made bold to tell Her Majesty that I owed no other obligation to my late master than his not dashing out the brains of a poor harmless creature found by chance in his field, which obligation was amply recompensed by the gain he had made in showing me through half the kingdom, and the price he had now sold me for, that the life I had since led was laborious enough to kill an animal of 10 times my strength, that my health was much impaired by the continual drudgery of entertaining the rabble every hour of the day, and that if my master had not thought my life in danger, Her Majesty would not have got so cheap a bargain. But as I was out of all fear of being ill-treated under the protection of so great and good an empress, the ornament of nature, the darling of the world, the delight of her subjects, the phoenix of the creation, so I hoped my late master's apprehensions would appear to be groundless, for I already found my spirits to be revived by the influence of her most august presence. This was the sum of my speech, delivered with great improprieties and hesitation, the latter part altogether framed in the style peculiar to that people, whereof I learned some phrases from Glumdalclitch while she was carrying me to court. The Queen, giving great allowance for my defectiveness in speaking, was, however, surprised at so much wit and good sense in so diminutive an animal. She took me in her own hand and carried me to the King, who was then retired to his cabinet. His Majesty, a prince of much gravity and austere countenance, not well observing my shape at first view, asked the Queen after a cold manner how long it was since she grew fond of a splacknock. For such, it seems, he took me to be, as I lay upon my breast in Her Majesty's right hand. But this princess, who hath an infinite deal of wit and humour, set me gently on my feet upon the scrutore, and commanded me to give His Majesty an account of myself, which I did in a very few words. And Glumdalclitch, who attended at the cabinet door and could not endure I should be out of her sight, being admitted, confirmed all that had passed from my arrival at her father's house. The King, although he be as learned a person as any in his dominions, and had been educated in the study of philosophy, and particularly mathematics, yet when he observed my shape exactly, and saw me walk erect before I began to speak, conceived I might be a piece of clockwork, which is in that country arrived to a very great perfection, contrived by some ingenious artist. But when he heard my voice, and found what I delivered to be regular and rational, he could not conceal his astonishment. He was by no means satisfied with the relation I gave him of the manner I came into his kingdom, but thought it a story concerted between Glumdalclitch and her father, who had taught me a set of words to make me sell at a higher price. Upon this imagination, he put several other questions to me, and still received rational answers, no otherwise defective than by a foreign accent and an imperfect knowledge in the language, with some rustic phrases which I had learned at the farmer's house, and did not suit the polite style of a court. His Majesty sent for 3 great scholars, who were then in their weekly waiting, according to the custom in that country. These gentlemen, after they had a while examined my shape with much nicety, were of different opinions concerning me. They all agreed I could not be produced according to the regular laws of nature, because I was not framed with a capacity of preserving my life, either by swiftness, or climbing of trees, or digging holes in the earth. They observed by my teeth, which they viewed with great exactness, that I was a carnivorous animal. Yet most quadrupeds, being an overmatch for me, and field mice, with some others, too nimble, they should not imagine how I should be able to support myself unless I fed upon snails and other insects, which they offered by many learned arguments to evince that I could not possibly do. One of them seemed to think that I might be an embryo or abortive birth, but this opinion was rejected by the other two, who observed my limbs to be perfect and finished, and that I had lived several years, as it was manifested from my beard, the stumps whereof they plainly discovered through a magnifying glass. They would not allow me to be a dwarf, because my littleness was beyond all degree of comparison, for the queen's favorite dwarf, the smallest ever known in that kingdom, was near 30 foot high. After much debate, they concluded unanimously that I was only Relplum Skullcath, which is interpreted literally Lusus Naturae, a determination exactly agreeable to the modern philosophy of Europe, whose professors, disdaining the old evasion of occult causes, whereby the followers of Aristotle endeavor in vain to disguise their ignorance, have invented this wonderful solution of all difficulties to the unspeakable advancement of human knowledge. After this decisive conclusion, I entreated to be heard a word or two. I applied myself to the king, and assured his majesty that I came from a country which abound with several millions of both sexes, and of my own stature, where the animals, trees, and houses were all in proportion, and where, by consequence, I might be as able to defend myself and to find sustenance as any of his majesty's subjects could do here, which I took for a full answer to those gentlemen's arguments. To this, they only replied with a smile of contempt, saying that the farmer had instructed me very well in my lesson. The king, who had a much better understanding, dismissing his learned men, sent for the farmer, who, by good fortune, was not yet gone out of town, having therefore first examined him privately, and then confronted him with me and the young girl, his majesty began to think that what we told him might possibly be true. He desired the queen to order that a particular care should be taken of me, and was of opinion that Glumdalclitch should still continue in her office of tending me, because he observed we had a great affection for each other. A convenient apartment was provided for her at court. She had a set of governesses appointed to take care of her education, a maid to dress her, and two other servants for menial offices. But the care of me was wholly appointed to herself. The queen commanded her own cabinet maker to contrive a box that might serve me for a bedchamber after the model that Glumdalclitch and I should agree upon. This man was a most ingenious artist, and according to my directions, in 3 weeks finished for me a wooden chamber of 16 foot square and 12 high, with sash windows, a door, and two closets like a London bedchamber. The board that made the ceiling was to be lifted up and down by two hinges to put in a bed ready furnished by Her Majesty's upholsterer, which Glumdalclitch took out every day to air and made it with her own hands, and letting it down at night, locked up the roof over me. A nice workman, who was famous for little curiosities, undertook to make me two chairs with backs and frames of a substance not unlike ivory, and two tables with a cabinet to put my things in. The room was quilted on all sides, as well as the floor and the ceiling, to prevent any accident from carelessness of those who carried me, and to break the force of a jolt when I went into a coach. I desired a lock for my door to prevent rats and mice from coming in. The smith, after several attempts, made the smallest that was ever seen among them, for I have known a larger at the gate of a gentleman's house in England. I made a shift to keep the key in a pocket of my own, fearing Glumdalclitch might lose it. The queen likewise ordered the thinnest silks that could be gotten to make me clothes not much thicker than an English blanket, very cumbersome till I was accustomed to them. They were after the fashion of the kingdom, partly resembling the Persian, and partly the Chinese, and are a very grave, decent habit. The queen became so fond of my company that she could not dine without me. I had a table placed upon the same at which Her Majesty ate, just at her elbow, and a chair to sit on. Glumdalclitch stood upon a stool on the floor near my table to assist and take care of me. I had an entire set of silver dishes and plates, and other necessaries, which, in proportion to those of the Queen, were not much bigger than what I have seen in a London toy shop for the furniture of a baby house. These my little nurse kept in her pocket in a silver box and gave me at meals as I wanted them, always cleaning them herself. No person dined with the Queen but the two princesses royal, the elder 16 years old, and the younger, at the time, 13 and a month. Her Majesty used to put a bit of meat upon one of my dishes, out of which I carved for myself, and her diversion was to see me eat in miniature. For the Queen, who had indeed but a weak stomach, took up at one mouthful as much as a dozen English farmers could eat at a meal, which to me was for some time a very nauseous sight. She would crunch the wing of a lark, bones and all, between her teeth, although it were 9 times as large as that of a full-grown turkey, and put a bit of bread in her mouth, as big as 2 12-penny loaves. She drank out of a golden cup, above a hogshead at a draught. Her knives were twice as long as a scythe set straight upon the handle. The spoons, forks, and other instruments were all in the same proportion. I remember when Glumdalclitch carried me, out of curiosity, to see some of the tables at court, where 10 or a dozen of these enormous knives and forks were lifted up together. I thought I had never till then beheld so terrible a sight. It is the custom that every Wednesday, which, as I have before observed, was their Sabbath, the King and Queen, with the royal issue of both sexes, dined together in the apartment of His Majesty, to whom I was now become a favorite, and at these times my little chair and table were placed at his left hand before one of the salt cellars. This prince took a pleasure in conversing with me, inquiring into the manners, religions, laws, government, and learning of Europe, wherein I gave him the best account I was able. His apprehension was so clear, and his judgment so exact, that he made very wise reflections and observations upon all I said. But I confess that after I had been a little too copious in talking of my own beloved country, of our trade and wars by sea and land, of our schisms in religion and parties in the state, the prejudices of his education prevailed so far that he could not forbear taking me up in his right hand and stroking me gently with the other, after an hearty fit of laughing, asked me whether I were a Whig or a Tory. Then turning to his first minister, who waited behind him with a white staff near as tall as the main mast of the royal sovereign, he observed how contemptible a thing was human grandeur, which could be mimicked by such diminutive insects as I. And yet, said he, I dare engage those creatures have their titles and distinctions of honor. They contrive little nests and burrows that they call houses and cities. They make a figure in dress and equipage. They love, they fight, they dispute, they cheat, they betray. And thus he continued on, while my color came and went several times with indignation to hear our noble country, the mistress of arts and arms, the scourge of France, the arbitress of Europe, the seat of virtue, piety, honor, and truth, the pride and envy of the world, so contemptibly treated. But as I was not in condition to request injuries, so upon mature thoughts, I began to doubt whether I were injured or no. For after having been accustomed several months to the sight and converse of this people, and observed every object upon which I cast mine eyes to be of proportional magnitude, the horror I had first conceived from their bulk and aspect was so far worn off that if I had then beheld a company of English lords and ladies in their finery and birthday clothes, acting their several parts in the most courtly manner of strutting and bowing and prating, to say the truth, I should have been strongly tempted to laugh as much at them as this king and his grandees did at me. Neither, indeed, could I forbear smiling at myself when the queen used to place me upon her hand towards a looking-glass, by which both our persons appeared before me in full view together, and there could nothing be more ridiculous than the comparison, so that I really began to imagine myself dwindled many degrees below my usual size. Nothing angered and mortified me so much as the queen's dwarf, who, being of the lowest stature that was ever in that country, for I verily think he was not full 30 foot high, became so insolent at seeing a creature so much beneath him that he would always affect to swagger and look big as he passed by me in the queen's antechamber while I was standing on a table talking with the lords or ladies of the court, and he seldom failed of a smart word or two upon my littleness, against which I could only revenge myself by calling him brother, challenging him to wrestle, and such repartees as are usual in the mouths of court pages. One day at dinner, this malicious little cub was so nettled with something I had said to him that, raising himself upon the frame of Her Majesty's chair, he took me up by the middle as I was sitting down, not thinking any harm, and let me drop into a large silver bowl of cream, and then ran away as fast as he could. I fell head over ears, and if I had not been a good swimmer, it might have gone very hard with me, for Glumdalclitch in that instant happened to be at the other end of the room, and the Queen was in such a fright that she wanted presence of mind to assist me. But my little nurse ran to my relief and took me out after I had swallowed above a quart of cream. I was put to bed. However, I received no other damage than the loss of a suit of clothes, which was utterly spoiled. The dwarf was soundly whipped, and as a further punishment, forced to drink up the bowl of cream into which he had thrown me. Neither was he ever restored to favor, for soon after the Queen bestowed him to a lady of high quality, so that I saw him no more, to my very great satisfaction. For I could not tell what extremity such a malicious urchin might have carried his resentment. He had before served me a scurvy trick, which set the Queen a-laughing, although at the same time she were heartily vexed, and would have immediately cashiered him, if I had not been so generous as to intercede. Her Majesty had taken a marrow bone upon her plate, and after knocking out the marrow, placed the bone again in the dish erect as it stood before. The dwarf, watching his opportunity while Glumdalclitch was gone to the sideboard, mounted the stool that she stood on to take care of me at meals, took me up in both hands, and squeezing my legs together, wedged them into the marrow bone above my waist, where I stuck for some time and made a very ridiculous figure. I believe it was near a minute before anyone knew what was become of me, for I thought it below me to cry out. But as princes seldom get their meat hot, my legs were not scalded, only my stockings and breeches in a sad condition. The dwarf, at my entreaty, had no other punishment than a sound whipping. I was frequently railed by the Queen upon account of my fearfulness, and she used to ask me whether the people of my country were as great cowards as myself. The occasion was this. The kingdom is much pestered with flies in summer, and these odious insects, each of them as big as a Dunstable lark, hardly gave me any rest while I sat at dinner, with their continual humming and buzzing about mine ears. They would sometimes alight upon my victuals and leave their loathsome excrement or spawn behind, which to me was very visible, although not to the natives of that country, whose large optics were not so acute as mine in viewing smaller objects. Sometimes they would fix upon my nose or forehead, where they stung me to the quick, smelling very offensively, and I could easily trace that viscous matter which our naturalists tell us enable those creatures to walk with their feet upwards upon a ceiling. I had much ado to defend myself against these detestable animals, and could not forbear starting when they came on my face. It was the common practice of the dwarf to catch a number of these insects in his hands, as schoolboys do among us, and let them out suddenly under my nose, on purpose to frighten me and divert the Queen. My remedy was to cut them in pieces with my knife as they flew in the air, wherein my dexterity was much admired. I remember one morning when Glumdalclitch had set me in my box upon a window, as she usually did in fair days to give me air, for I durst not venture to let the box be hung on a nail out of the window, as we do with cages in England. After I had lifted up one of my sashes and sat down at my table to eat a piece of sweet cake for my breakfast, above 20 wasps, allured by the smell, came flying into the room, humming louder than the drones of as many bagpipes. Some of them seized my cake and carried it piecemeal away. Others flew about my head and face, confounding me with the noise and putting me in the utmost terror of their stings. However, I had the courage to rise and draw my hanger and attack them in the air. I dispatched four of them, but the rest got away, and I presently shut my window. These insects were as large as partridges. I took out their stingers, found them an inch and a half long, and as sharp as needles. I carefully preserved them all, and having since shown them with some other curiosities in several parts of Europe. Upon my return to England, I gave three of them to Gresham College, and kept the fourth for myself.
So once the king started in on Gulliver, did you start to sense the Stockholm Syndrome thing happening? You know, it's like when the Lilliputians would make fun of him, he was always able to kind of keep himself centered. Like, well, you know, secretly somewhere inside of himself, he's like, yeah, well, you know, I'm still bigger than you. Whatever. But when a giant is making fun of you and, you know, teasing him and saying, oh, they love, they fight, they dispute, they cheat, they betray. And thus he continued on, while my color came and went several times with indignation to hear our noble country, the mistress of arts and arms, the scourge of France, the arbitress of Europe, the seat of virtue, piety, honor, and truth, the pride and envy of the world so contemptuously treated. And of course, the scourge of France thing is kind of interesting. That's going straight back to Agincourt and Poitiers and Crecy, the Hundred Years' War, where the English had the longbow and just annihilated them. Now, admittedly, the French came back and did the same thing and took the country back. But I'm sure there are still people who talk about being the scourge of France. And it is not entirely all that much different from what happens here in the United States. There are many parts of the South where talk is of being an occupied country, that the Civil War really didn't end 150 years ago, that it continues on, and the occupation continues. And it's a historical memory that most Americans have never really lived with. We tend to be kind of, every minute is a new minute. But I know from talking to my husband when he was in Slovakia, you know, history goes back a long way when your family doesn't keep moving. And those of you who've been listening to Craftlit prior to this, you know my family has kept moving. I started in Croton, I went to Arizona, now we're in Virginia, all since 2006. You know, our roots do not run deep anywhere that we live, but because people kept records, we know where we started. One branch of my family is DAR. One branch of my family goes back to Battle of Hastings. And another branch of my family goes back to snake oil salesman on the frontier and Mary the Cherokee. It was my great-great-great-grandmother. And that's all we've got on our marriage certificate was Mary the Cherokee. So it's America and Americans sometimes have a hard time getting that sense of historical memory. You know, that a place could consider itself the hero of a battle that happened 500 years before and still talk about it kind of almost in present tense. But it's really not that weird. I think Americans are the weird ones on this because we have been so transient within our own country and the world. It was also, I think, kind of a shock to realize when people sailed for the New World back in the early 1600s and showed up here, they were never going to see home again. The vast majority of them never going to see home again. And that was true up through and including Ellis Island. You know, most of the people who squeaked out of Europe during famines and bloodshed and war and disaster, if they squeaked out and made it here, the chances of them ever seeing home and the family that they left behind was nil. And some people chose to just forget because it was easier. And some people wrote down the records. And I know a lot of students of mine craved that information, but they were second and sometimes third generation Americans, and they wanted to know where they came from. They wanted to know their history. And you see the legacy of that kind of history in a book like Gulliver's Travels. Now, part of the modern philosophy that I think, or what I see as being kind of modern philosophy that I think is so interesting about this section of the book, and that you're going to start seeing more of, I think, as we continue on, is this kind of Stockholm syndrome thing, where the longer Gulliver has to listen to these giants telling him that he is a little, little man, the more he is going to start to believe them. And it's sad, sure, but it's certainly not hard to understand. And I think that's one of the things that makes me so impressed with this book, and find it so much fun to listen to. And on that note, I will leave you. Next week, chapter 4 is more fun. And actually, I think I'm probably going to do 4 and 5 together next week, because I'll tell you, I think they're two of the grossest chapters in the book, and I'm just gonna get rid of them. We're just gonna do them together all at once, and kind of be done with them. But this week was the beginning of kind of seeing a not so pretty side of Brobdingnag, and it's gonna keep going that way for a little while. So you can start to see why they stick with Lilliput for the movies, can't you? It starts to get more complicated. And complicated makes for a harder movie. So there we go. I hope you have a great week. For those of you who are subscriber supporters, you will get your new audio on time. In theory, the little autoresponder should just push that stuff out to you. And because I know some of you who are subscriber supporters are also knitters, but knitters who don't have a whole lot of time to listen, I have included the links to all of the free patterns for you as well. I don't usually push out the same exact information to Craftlet and just the book supporters, but this week I did. So have a great week. I will talk to you soon. And I'll be tweeting from TNNA. So if you are on the interwebs and pay attention to Twitter, you will see me. Take care. Have a great one. Bye-bye. There are many ways to listen to Craftlit. You can listen on your smartphone via the Stitcher Radio app. You can subscribe free through iTunes, where you can download and listen to the iPhone, iTouch, and Android app, where you'll receive occasional extras for the show. Craftlit is supported in a number of ways. Knit Circus, the free e-newsletter featuring 3 rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. Also, the What Would Madame Defarge Knit series, Volume 2, What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit, is now in pre-orders. You can find out more from the links in the show notes at craftlit.com. Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories from the heart and home. And Seedpod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative publishing books not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. If you would like to help support the show, please know there are various ways to donate, and all of them help keep Craftlit and Just the Books free and available to you whenever you feel the need for a good story. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.